Butler's Street Recordings proudly presents Garrett Teitelbaum. It's nice to see he's working.
Jocelyn and Craig's thing at Rivertown Brewing.
Yeah,
Pat's Murraysville. Yeah, they do that. So she does the special effects makeup for that. So that ruins all weekends in Halloween.
All like, of the entire month of October. Sure. Yeah.
So I sit at home. I usually have like three horror films that I pop up, watch three a week at least.
Yeah. What's your favorite series in the Halloween category? I guess scary category is horror. That's the word that people use in
horror.
Film.
Yeah, they say horror films.
Horror would be the word for Halloween aged films.
I don't know if I'd say a favorite series. I mean, every series gets disappointing after a certain amount. I've always like consistently impressed with Final Destination. Or just how ridiculous the deaths get over and over and over again.
Yeah, the Saw series was appealing to me for the same reason.
Exactly. They were like, hey, you want to see this? How about you see it in 3D? And that was going to blow your mind. Oh, remember that story? Yeah, it's still there.
It's just reboots and sequels. That's all. And it doesn't even have to be horror. That's the genre of choice. It's just reboots, sequels, and superheroes.
That's why most of the time I'm disappointed with horror. Like, I'm usually a pretty tough critic when it comes to films overall, but I'm really tough when it comes to horror.
The most disappointed I've ever been in theaters was at the Blair Witch Project.
The final original moment.
Yeah. I've never been so mad that an end of a movie was that.
See, I love that movie.
And it's saw it when I was probably in sixth grade.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Have you revisited it
since? No.
Or you're just that disappointed?
I was just that mad. It's... Maybe I'm naive and I wanted to see something that you weren't going to get to see.
That's what made it so scary for me. It was just like never seeing that villain. I just saw the remake.
Okay.
The one that just came out. And I was very disappointed with that.
Okay.
Because, I mean, spoiler alert, they do show you.
Oh, really?
And you're just like, yeah, it's scary. But then it's just like, here's some more shit that doesn't make any sense and more plot. And
now, did you ever see the second one?
I did. Book of Shadows. That was a mess. Okay. That movie. Yeah, that was a mess.
That was with the original cast and then they just had a big budget.
The remake is so weird. So it's a movie that's a sequel, and in this universe, in the sequel universe, the original film exists as a film. So these people live in our universe, quote unquote our universe, but the Blair Witch has come to life now. So they all knew the movie. They all saw the movie.
Right.
And now in this universe, like, the curse is becoming real because someone has read the Book of Shadows. And so that's what it's called, Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows. And it's fucking awful. It's terrible. It's just a terrible movie. It makes no sense and it's not good at all. But the remake of it's a sequel, but it's a sequel to the original film. And they're considering this newer film now exists in the same filmic universe where this is the guy's sister. So the main guy, it's Heather, is his older sister. So he's going to see what happened to her.
Nice. All right. This is It's Nice to See He's Working. And that conversation about the Blair Witch Project was with my good friend, Dave Foreman.
Hey.
Here on episode 24 of the podcast. Who's your favorite athlete who wore 24?
Oh, my God. That's a terrible question.
Not a good question.
I couldn't even name, like, any number. You could name any number.
What's your favorite episode of the TV show 24? Is that a better route to go?
My mom watched that a lot. I never understood the whole appeal because so many people die in 24 hours. That's a lot of deaths.
He never takes a bathroom break.
Nope.
And nothing takes that long to drive to.
No.
It was one of those shows I couldn't get into. But I like a lot of TV.
Like seeing Jack Bauer fight a lot of people. Kiefer Sutherland, good for him, getting a reinvigoration.
Yeah,
after being like
absolutely.
A horror icon as a kid, and then kind of going away, and then coming back and be like, guess what? I'm an old dude who fights people.
Well, he has a new show that by the time this episode airs may have been canceled. Yeah. Who knows?
Designated
Survivor, which is a true thing that during the State of the Union address. Every one cabinet member is put in the Situation Room in case something happens to the Capitol. And in this show, apparently it does in the first episode. And now he's not Jack Bauer. He's a guy who wears glasses. And he has to be the new president.
I love that concept, too, where it's just like our democratic system is in such a place where it's like so broken and so inept, where it's just like, oh, no, a bomb? Well, we better reinvent the government with this guy who's one step above the janitor. It's like, have you ever done anything? They talk to this guy in the trailer, and it's just like, Well, he's never done anything. He's never led people. He's not even elected official. He's just a guy.
He's just hanging glasses. Out.
He's just Jack Bauer.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, thank
That'll
you.
That'll pick up, don't
I hope so.
Yeah, they're going to know that we were cool motorcycle guys here so talking about
this podcast
24.
Recorded on a motorcycle.
And Dave Forward and I just got to spend the last probably 2 hours together sitting down having a wonderful meal because Dave, for the last 5 or 6 months, I would say, has been running a food blog, Dave the Gastronome.
David the Gastronome. Sorry.
That's okay. I should apologize. You don't have to be sorry that I messed up the name of your blog.
It's all good. No, it's the takeoff of David the Gnome, the old Nickelodeon cartoon who I always felt an affinity to because he shared my name, and I, too, like getting my nose rubbed and riding on foxes. So
it's a hobby for the best of us.
Exactly.
I had an affinity for Hey Arnold when that first came out because I was in the fourth grade, and he was in the fourth grade, and I thought we would grow up together. And he stayed in the fourth grade.
He stayed the same age, and you got older.
Now I'm just sad and alone. And he
became creepy when you guys hung out.
He and Gerald are not friends with me anymore. They won't do any of the fun bits I like to run.
I remember that really depressing episode of The Pigeon Man. Do you remember that?
Oh,
episode?
Yes,
Holy
absolutely.
Crap. That really affected me as a kid, where they went up to the roof and this guy was just like, I'm a crazy old man. They're like, we hate you, crazy old man. He's like, no, I'm just really sad.
I'm just a sad man
just a
with
sad
this
man
pigeons.
Who loves pigeons.
Well, AMC had a show for a while about Mike Tyson, and he was a pigeon hoarder.
Really?
I don't know what the term is, but...
A pigeon handler?
Handler?
Grower?
He had his own carrier pigeons. He had pigeons on his roof in New York, and that's how he would relax before a fight. He would just go out, and he goes, he feeds my pigeons.
He's a fascinating character. I've always wanted to see his one-man show. I've always heard amazing things.
Yeah.
But they say it's very moving, very deep. But I also love Mike Tyson Mysteries. On Adult Swim.
Very funny show.
Is that a reason? Is that the reason why there's a pigeon on that show?
Yeah,
because
I believe
he owns pigeons, voiced by Norm Macdonald. Which is
I haven't seen that in a while. The first handful of those episodes when that came out, I was very into.
I was super into Adult Swim for a really long time, and then when Aqua Teen Hunger Force went away, that's when I stopped watching. I felt bad because I still like. I love Rick and Morty. That's
Rick and Morty
my
has
show.
Been just fantastic
Incredible.
So far.
That's probably my favorite cartoon on TV right now.
Were you a big? Fan of Community and the other stuff.
I
Harmon's
liked Community.
Put
I definitely abandoned ship after what was it, the third season when they started moving the time around.
Yeah,
and then they killed off Chevy Chase, and that's when I stopped watching.
Yeah, that's
and then
fair.
I was really impressed that they worked out the thing with Yahoo, and they were trying to come back. I didn't watch it, so I was probably the reason why they all went away. But
I did. Yeah. I did the Yahoo episodes. I finished that one out.
Was it good?
Entertaining?
Did you feel
yeah.
redeemed?
I don't know.
They're still talking about a movie, right? It's been six
seasons
of
a movie.
Yeah. Right? They're still talking about doing a movie.
We'll see. Donald Glover left, it became a little bit less of the show I liked watching. Hmm. I think that those first three seasons are some really strong episodes, and I like that Harmon gets to do bottle episodes in that show. He's like, now I want to do our mafia one where we're running the cafeteria and we do chicken fingers. It's like, oh, we want to do a Western, so we'll do paintball in the school. So it's cool that he gets to do whatever he wants.
And it really pushed a lot of what television's shows could do as well, with the claymation episode and the puppet episode and the music episode. They got some big names, and it was really impressive.
So beyond food and television discussion, which we will do plenty of, we are here to talk about comedy and working in the arts. And I know Dave from his time on the Well-Known Strangers. So one of the premier teams here in the greater Pittsburgh area, hosts of the Pittsburgh Improv Jam every Thursday night at the CLO Cabaret. And that's at 10 o'clock?
10 p.m. Yeah,
10 p.m. jam every single Thursday. And when did you guys start doing that? Because it's the longest running jam here in town at this point.
Yeah, it's really long running. We actually inherited it from Hustlebot. I don't know if they inherited it, but they started it, and it was a very strong core, the group there. They had a really strong following, and that was the game in town. If you wanted to do improv in the city, that was it for a long time before any of the theaters came along. And I think some of the theaters even came out of that group there. I know that Abby Fudor and Mike Rubino, they were huge in the beginning.
Well, Abby, I think, was involved in, Friday Night Improvs?
Right,
that was
too.
In the basement at the cathedral because Regina, who I know on my new house team over at Arcade, that's how she knows Abby and Robin and the rest of that crew. But I didn't move here back then. I've just been a young man trying to get my feet wet I was on a house team at Steel City Improv, and you were on the all-male improv team over there called Panic.
Yes.
Probably 3 or 4 years ago now.
Yeah, that was about 3 years ago, yeah.
And then the Strangers were formed right at that same time.
They had started, I want to say, maybe a year before that point, maybe half a year. Because I think either 2012 or 2013 is when they started September.
Okay.
So the big show, it was always the three teams, and the big team was the faculty.
Right.
So that was the big fourth team. And when One of the Strangers came along, they quickly rose to the top. They were like the highlight team. And so they were always second. So we'd always see One on Strangers, and you'd always see the faculty.
Yeah.
And then they had the two house teams that rotated in Panic, moved into that rotation really nicely. I think that was around April of like 2013.
And I know that's a team that consists of Jerome Fitzgerald, who has been on my podcast, mm-hmm. Chris Wright, who's a good friend of mine, mm-hmm. and DJ Kingsbury. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm missing a few other
Pete
names.
Pete McMahon was on that team.
Pete.
Mike Pedido was on that team. I feel like... Oh, Derek Minto was on that team.
Wow.
Yeah, because I was like, who's sweaty? Who else is sweaty?
another sweaty man.
Yeah, and Derek and I gladly share my title for sweatiest man in Pittsburgh with him.
He's in the running.
He holds it down.
Yeah, he's a sweaty guy.
But I loved doing shows with that group because it was so weird, and it was such a bizarre. You never knew what to expect.
Yeah.
Everybody was so unpredictable. And like what I love about One on Strangers is that I know my teammates. I know them as improvisers. I know them as human beings. And I never knew my team Panic as improvisers. I knew they were as people, you know, I knew their personalities. But like, you had no idea what to expect going out there. And it was scary. It was very thrilling. But it didn't work as often as it worked.
Well, it's a very different landscape now that we have in Pittsburgh comedy that, you know, I don't know that you could even facilitate an all-male team. But what do you think is the biggest thing that got in the way of having a team full of testosterone?
Agreement, I think. A lot of it, just like the guys were very, we were all loud. We all had very big personalities.
A lot of big personalities on
that
team.
And so sharing the scene, sharing the elements, sharing that what you say is as much as valid and as important as what I'm saying. It became very difficult to navigate shows together. So we would have great scenes. We would have good one-offs, but making that work into a cohesive story or arc or even Harold became very difficult. But we had some incredible group games. Because as you know, with a group game, you come out, everybody needs to have their own personal stance, their own very strong one line. And we had that. Those everybody were... just showed up every single time with like, no, this is about this and this is about that. And so it was like, I remember one that was a Donkey Kong. We recreated the Mario Brothers Donkey Kong on stage. So we're jumping over people. Some people are barrels. Some people are Donkey Kong. Some people are the princess. It was absolutely nuts. I'll never forget that.
That's great. Group games are such a struggle for so many teams. What do you think your kind of style in a group game with the Well-Known Strangers is?
So with me personally, I always am a kind of definer, and I'm always like a puncher. So I always provide that punch to like that line. So I always either speak last or speak first in the group game, where I'm like, this is what it's all about. Or at the end, I'm like, this is what's different about the game. And this is my new unique perspective.
For the audience who might not know, because I know I've got stand-up friends and people that might not have seen enough improv show, a group game kind of takes place as a palate cleanser between beats of a Harold. So you'll see 1, 2, 3 scenes with different characters. And then a group game is more of a full team participation just to kind of offset the show, maybe bring back whatever the suggestion was or something fun to just kind of work as a segue if it's done, I think, effectively. But it's a good way to let energy out if a team doesn't know how to kind of mesh with everybody on stage at the same time. So with teams like Panic, where it's a ton of big personalities, it's great because you kind of have to be high energy to show that it's not just a normal two-person Harold scene. But I watch a lot of young improvisers really struggle with that piece of it. So do you have any advice for people who maybe haven't figured out a group game dynamic yet?
I think the key, and this is a key for so much improv, is don't be afraid to edit.
Yeah.
So much, I'll be sitting in the audience and I'll see just like people will flounder. People say, look, the joke's already been said. And you can tell that panic starts to, you know, it starts to set in their eyes. And it's just like, help me, get me out of this situation. And people, you can look on the sidelines and they're like, I don't know what to do, but you're in control. You have the power. Edit it. No one will ever or more times than not, no one will be upset with you for editing
for
too
cutting
soon,
something, yeah.
Rather than saving them from too long of a groove game or too long of a scene.
Now, do you enjoy Herald versus other forms that you've gotten to do over your career?
Personally, no. I do not enjoy Herald at all.
What do you think the biggest challenge is in trying to do a Herald, which is almost a long-form play, I tell people?
What it becomes for me is it becomes almost like a Play-Doh set that you find yourself in where you're like, you have all these amazing ingredients and all these amazing materials and unique abilities brought on stage by every member of the team, and you're forcing them into, here's square A, here's square B, and here's square C. And remember what we did in A, B, and C? We now live in those worlds, and we have to follow these paths. And if we want to add something new, it has to live in these worlds. And if it doesn't, it can add a lot of confusion. It can throw things off. And a lot of the time with group game, you get so in your head, like, what can I do now with the entire group that feeds into A, B, and C, that it ends up not being very good or very successful. And it becomes a very big point of concern and stress for people where they're like, they get frozen. And again, that's why those scenes go on too long, because people are standing there on the sidelines saying, what can I add to this? What can I make it different? How can I make it better? And meanwhile, sometimes the best thing to do is just cut it.
Let's get this one over with and start the next one where it's a fun new thing. Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that you're allowed to stop something from going badly if you see it going that way, that the edit is still going to be okay. But people want you to end on a laugh. People want to let you, they don't want you to feel like you're failing. And sometimes I think as a sideline person, you're like, I know it's bad, and they probably know it's bad, but they have to get out of it so I can end this on a good note. Sometimes there's not a good note.
That's very true, unfortunately.
You just got to go sometimes. Yeah. So then tell me what that experience was like being asked to be on The Well-Known Strangers after watching them and kind of seeing that they were the perennial team at that point when they brought you on.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, speaking completely candidly here, being on Panic, the best part of the night when I performed was watching Well-Known Strangers and watching the faculty. Because these were guys that just, they clicked together. They knew what they were doing. They knew each other. They supported each other. And, like, they were the team that I wanted to be. And so when I was asked to audition for Well-Known Strangers, I was really excited. I was really impressed. And I felt, like, you know, almost that imposter fallacy where it's like, oh, I'm not good enough to be on this team. I'm not that strong. But going and starting off with these people, it was so intimidating because they had these relationships with each other. They knew each other from all these performances and the weekly practices and the getting to know each other and the shows on Thursday and the shows during the Totally Free Mondays as well. They knew each other so well. And so I was an outsider for a little while. I didn't mesh it, but that was just such a short amount of time before I just fell in with everyone and we all just cohesed beautifully. And having that team is just such an amazing gift that I know no matter what scene I go out and do, no matter what scene I start, they're going to be there and they're going to help me support me. I can jump off every joke cliff that I find anywhere and they're going to be there as my parachute and I'm not going to fail because I have such a good, strong team behind me. And everybody, I like to feel that everybody feels that way about each other, that we have that trust in each other. And that's so huge. That's key to any good improv team, is that you trust everyone else. You know they're going to be there for you. You know they're going to back you up.
Yeah, other than finding the right group of people to assimilate into, what advice do you have for somebody who might want to be a part of the community but isn't yet?
I don't even know if it's the right people. You know, like, it's not like a love relationship. It's like you can make it work, I feel like, with anyone that has the same mindset as you. Mm-hmm. And so once you find those people where you're like, I like the way they perform, I like the way they click, you know, just going up to them and just saying, you know, do you want to do a duo? Do you want to do a one-off at some place? And then I think the jam is such a great, great opportunity. You can come, you could have had one class or you could be doing this for years, and you can come up and we're all on the same level and we're all going to support each other. We're all going to be there to help foster that community, because we're nothing without new blood.
Right.
You know, we could all see each other and go out and see each other play, and it's fun and it's nice to see the same teams, but until you get new people in coming to that jam or coming to new events or, you know, taking classes and then coming out to shows, it's just going to stay stagnant. It's going to fade away. So I love having that jam as an opportunity, and us having the Well-Known Strangers as kind of the ambassadors and saying, come in, play with us. Look at how we play together. You can play with us too, and we're going to support you, and you're going to feel good, and you're going to walk away feeling like this is something I want to do at the end of the night.
With the Strangers being around as long as they have, and doing the jam, do you guys still find yourselves in weekly practices? Is that still the focus of the team?
Absolutely. Every Tuesday we meet at Cathedral of Learning and we practice. And it's so good because, you know, we've gone through different coaches, we've gone through different forms, we've gone through different kind of structures and goals and approaches, and every single practice we do something new and learn something new about each other, and that just makes it even better with each other.
Since Harold's not your favorite form, what is it that you would enjoy doing the most on stage?
What we do now, I am a huge fan of, and it's not really a form at all, but it's more of a like a clover almost. So we'll have our starting point and we'll set like a nice big loop around the left side where we'll hit some pretty similar themes or concepts or character we'll follow, and then we'll start brand new, and then it will take that and we'll take it as far as it can go, and then we'll start brand new again, and then at the end everything intertwines together almost naturally, where either whether it's theme or whether it's an editing technique that we've invented during that set, or a character that we've brought back and followed their whole trajectory. I love that because it's so rewarding as an improviser, and I think it's rewarding as an audience member too, to say, I remember that joke, I remember that character, and now I get to see it come to fruition, and it's just so nice to grant that.
Well, and that's what people leave thinking about is the end, is those final callbacks and built in kind of like, oh yeah, the whole show was, even though they made it up, it does feel cohesive. Of the people you get to play with on The Strangers, and I'm not here to make you rank human beings, but who's the person on the team that does something that you admire?
Wow. I've always admired Ben Amiri. He's just an incredible improviser. He can take and he can support and add a shade to a scene or a character that you would never expect, but works perfectly. And he can have that one line in a scene, because he's such a good listener, you know, that one line in a scene that just defines the entire scene, and sometimes defines the entire show.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, okay, this is what it's about, and this is the route we're going to take now. And I love his big characters, and I love his smaller, lower characters too. I just like playing with him.
Yeah, he's very good at being a person that's different than him, and Alistair and a lot of the members of that team are.
Alistair's facial, it's just like, I wouldn't trade that for the world. His facial abilities to change his entire character based on his face is just outstanding.
He and Anna C. Riley and Missy Moreno and Connor all have theater backgrounds, and it's so obvious when you see them on stage how good they are at not rushing to meet what you said with something, but to react to it naturally, have a facial response, and register what it was, and do the next thing that makes sense in the story. And I love watching all four of them. And it's not because of their improv training, because they're very talented improvisers, but it's because you can tell that they have presence up there, and they know how to deliver a character.
Absolutely. I'm very jealous of that ability
that
Connor and Alistair have on our team to just lose themselves in a character. It's just, it's so impressive.
How do you stay out of your head if you're building a character out there?
I think I'm always in my head.
Are
That's
you?
My secret. Yeah, like I'm no matter what, I'm always in my head. I'm looking for that opening. I'm looking for that me-shaped hole in that scene that I can build on in the next scene, or that me-shaped concept where it's just like, I know I can do this well, and I know I can keep this concept going. So this is what I'm going to bring to the table. And this is what I'm going to add, and this is what I'm going to support.
I was very happy that we got to finally hang out, because like a lot of people in improv, you know people like tangentially, and we don't like know each other. We've hung out at a handful of parties at either, you know, the Nolans recently or at Mike Padido's house for previous 4th of July's and things. Mm-hmm. But the first time I think I like aggressively was like, we need to be friends, was when you posted on Facebook that you and Tiffany were out at the Dolly Parton concert.
Absolutely.
A couple months ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, why am I not with Dave right now? This would make my night so much better.
She has always loved Dolly Parton through and through.
Yeah.
At Christmas time, Tiffany's my wife. At Christmas time, we have a tiny Dolly Parton tree, which is pink, and it has ornaments that she created, and we hang them on the tree.
Wow.
We listen to the Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers Christmas CD at Christmas time, and we watched Coat of Many Colors on repeat. So she's always loved Dolly Parton. So when she found out that Dolly Parton was coming, she works for Eaton Park. And so she worked it out with them that she was able to get tickets in their box
to
watch. So it was like, this was a pinnacle moment for her.
And this Absolutely.
Was like, and I was going to do everything I could to go there and support her. And I probably wouldn't go on my own.
Fair.
But I will always support her, and I will stand by she's my woman.
Yeah. That's okay. You made that joke. I was going to do a Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Christmas in the Snow instead of Islands in the Stream. It wasn't going to be better.
Yeah, it works.
It was fine.
It works. It still works.
So if it's a concert you go to for the missus, what's a concert that you went to for you over the last year?
I dragged her to the Death from Above 1979 when they came to Ultra Bar, and that was an absolutely unbelievable show. Lauren Kozlowski, an old member of Well on Strangers, and I, we share a lot of musical and film tastes, and so that was one of the bands that he said, if you get a chance, you have to go see them live and go to their concert, and I was just absolutely blown away by their abilities, and I've always loved them as a band.
I don't know Lauren yet, but we did give him a shout-out in the Justin and Jerome episode, if he would like to come do an episode of my podcast, because he has Roach Coach, where he breaks down nu metal. There was a nu metal band from my high school, Coping with Ignorance. Oh. I have both of their albums. If he wants to listen to those with me and come on my show, I'd be happy to do a hybrid episode. And kind of the format of today's episode is a hybrid, because David the Gastronome and I got to go out and eat dinner together. And Dave has been running his food blog now. And I'm always interested to find out what restaurants are going out here in Pittsburgh. And I don't know if you're the more articulate diner than me, if you want to tell the folks a little bit about what we did tonight.
Sure. Yeah. So we went to Morcia. And that is the second restaurant from Justin Severino, the founder and creator of Cure, the chef over there, head chef. And he founded Morcia on the concept of kind of this, the same concept as Morcia, same concept as Cure, with the charcuterie, the in-house made meats, cured meats, all nose to tail, making sure you use all the parts of the animal and treat it all respectfully and use everything locally grown and very farm to table, focus on that. And so Morcia is more of the Spanish influence, where Cure is more of the American approach. It's all tapas, small plates, small little either toasts or tastes, lots of meat, probably more charcuterie than I've seen on any other menu.
Yeah.
It was very impressive. And one thing I was very proud that we took a absolute opportunity of is the option of all the meats.
All of the meats. That's the best option.
Simply labeled all the meats. And so we did that, and that was absolutely incredible.
You did that. A couple of oxtails, which were fantastic.
Just a braised oxtail and a piece of toast with some little bit of cheese on top. It was just that roasted, deep earthiness of the sweetness of the meat that you get. It's just... it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, the waitress described it as deconstructed French onion soup, and very close. But that palate, just I can't think of the last thing I've tasted that was that good.
And that richness comes from that deep cooking, that deep braising, hours and hours that you put into that meat that you just can't fake. I mean, you can take a piece of meat and you can do a couple things with it and make it seem like you put a lot more time into it. But a piece like that, when you braise it and it gets that tender, fall apart quality, it's just that it's incomparable.
Now, highly recommend the restaurant, and you can check out the write-up on it on davidthegastronome.com. Check out Dave's blog. What of the places you've been so far that you've gotten to feature, do you have a favorite?
Where I just went for my birthday at the end of August, we went to Altius, and that dining experience for me is just like heads and tails above so many other restaurants that I've been to. The view alone is just incomparable. You see the entire city from the top of Mount Washington. It's floor to ceiling windows. The entire restaurant on three sides is surrounded by glass, and it's two floors. And you get there, and you're just like, oh, this is nice. This is a nice meal. And the menu is very inventive. It's very different. It's all nice takes on classic American stuff. I had a double rack of lamb there that was just absolutely incredible. My mom had a piece of salmon that was beautiful over a shrimp and grits. My dad did this giant bone-in ribeye. My wife did the local chicken with a, it was like French. It was really gorgeous over like a corn hash. And the meal, the food is just outstanding. And then on top of that, the service is incredible. Like the water glass is never empty. The plates are constantly being cleared and cleaned. And they're asking you if you need anything. And they're constantly checking on you and taking care of you, making you feel like you're the only person in the entire restaurant. And so it's just a special, special occasion. And you can tell everyone cares. And they feel like you're a valued member of that restaurant when you're in there. And
it's so important because I've gone into places and felt just like such cold service from people, and it's such a miserable time. You don't have a good experience. You don't enjoy it. You don't want to go back. And that so much can be sold to me just based on the personalities of the types of people you bring on to work and staff your establishment. So
absolutely. Yeah, that's such
a huge thing.
It's so easy to do, too. You don't have to have high-quality ingredients. You don't have to have very expensive food to just be a nice person, to just come in and say, thank you for being in my restaurant. Let me make you feel like this is worth your time and worth your money and that you're a valued member. Another one of my favorite restaurants is Istanbul Sofra, which is in Regent Square.
Yeah. I forget that we live pretty close to each other. Yeah, right, I'm in Swissvale.
Okay, yeah, exactly. And it's right on that corner there. And, you know, in Middle Eastern, it's good. It's a nice meal to go out to. But every time I go there, the manager's there, and he treats me like I'm family. He's like, how are you doing? How's everything going? How was your meal? Like, I got the whole fish last time I was there, the whole branzino. And he was like, did you like it? Did you try it like this? Did you enjoy this? And I said, yeah, it was exceptional. And it felt like I was talking to a friend. So it's just, that's so easy to do, but it seems so difficult for so many restaurants to grasp that concept of you don't have to have the most expensive food or the highest quality anything, but just be a nice person and just have good service.
Well, I've done customer service and I've managed customer service people at different times in my life, and it does blow my mind how few people are good at it. Because it, for me, it just comes very naturally, and I give all the credit to having good parents, but I just was raised to treat people with respect, and I'm at work to do what I've been employed to do. And if it's to make sure, like when I worked for a health club, these are people you see on a daily basis. They do become like family. They're in at the same time, and you ask them about their kids and you get to know them. But like some people just have no interest. It's check an ID and let you go on your way. And I don't get that idea. I don't know if that's something that everybody can do. I wish that we would hire fewer bad people at service jobs.
I agree with that. Yeah, that lack of empathy there that just falls through. It just allow, you know, just like, I don't have to be there.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be there either, but I've entered in your place of business. So you're at least there for a longer period than I am.
Yeah.
To serve, and that's your role and your purpose is to provide good service, to be a good person. And it's just
I want business to come back.
Yeah. Yeah, but so many people just become apathetic and just don't care. I think it's a lack of investment, too. Like, I don't feel like I'm an employee here. I don't feel like I am valued.
Or the manager doesn't care about me. My boss does. I don't matter to them. I'm a paycheck.
Exactly. So why should I care about anyone else here? Why should I care about who comes in day to day? But, you know, I think a lot of it's fake it till you make it, too. Just be overly nice.
Yeah.
No one's going to complain.
Yeah, I think you have to. I remember distinctly getting like an Employee of the Month award in college when I was managing the rec center in the month after I got my heart broken when me and my like ex of 2.5 years had broken up. But it's because you have to fake it. You have to put on a brave face and throw yourself into something else when other shit's not going well to just focus on how to make this moment as good as you can for somebody else.
Right. I mean, I can go home and I can be a miserable piece of shit, but while I'm at work, you know, you put a smile on my face and you know, try to be nice to the people that you deal with.
As far as diet-wise, was there a time when you were a more picky eater?
Oh, man. I wish I could say yes, but no.
You've always been open to anything?
Even as a kid, I was always like, give me that weird thing. I'm going to eat that. What is that? Let me try that. I remember, like, even as a very young kid, having these arbitrary things where I'd be like, oh, I don't like squid, or oh, I don't like octopus. But then I would try it and be like, no, I like this.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, I like this. And a big concept for me is communication, over communication and knowledge. And so if I can find out from my server, like, what exactly am I being served and what am I eating, then I'm going to be a lot more comfortable going into it.
Sure.
A lot of the times you go to a place and you'll get a meat platter and they just lay it down and walk away. And you're like, well, what is what any are of all stuff? These items? Right. How do I know if I like it or not? And where does it come from? And what animal is it? And what part of the animal does it come from? And how is it treated? So knowing that, like, oh, I might like duck over beef, or I might like a pork belly more than I like pork butt.
Yeah.
It's finding those things out and becoming a more knowledgeable eater, that where you can really hone your taste.
So our waitress was great tonight, and you definitely got her opinion on a lot of stuff, and she was very knowledgeable, not just on the menu, but on the menu that day, which I thought was impressive, that she knew how the oysters were today versus other days. And maybe some of that's BS and stuff, but you like to think she's at least knowledgeable. She did give us the best recommendation that she could have with that oxtail. But one thing I was curious about is, how do you, as somebody who has to now take this meal and go put it to pen and paper, or type, I'm assuming that's how most people do things now, how do you remember everything? Because you weren't taking notes while we were eating. We got all of the meats. There's an entire platter. Are you just that knowledgeable on food that you knew what each thing was through her, just when she explained it? And now you're like, I can talk articulately about each of these meats.
Yeah, I don't really have a very good memory at all, except when it comes to food. Like, I can picture still in my mind that cross-cut layout. Like, when she pointed to each of them and she was like, here's the lomo and here's the Iberico ham and here's the jamón from Spain and here's, just every different cut and every different style. And I do, after the fact, I do look at the menu, I bring it up, and I say, well, what was available that day? I always take an itemized receipt so I know exactly what dishes I got.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the charcuterie platters, they do get overwhelming. They do get daunting with, like, what was the duck and what was the beef and what cut was it and where did it come from? But thankfully, I guess with anything, there's only a set number of variations on a style of food. So you're like, it was either, the beef
one
from
of these
the,
two.
Right, the cheek or the pork. And then I can use Google and I can discover
what
was it. And the flavor profile always sticks with me.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing, is remembering what it tasted like. If I can't remember 100% what it was or what it was called, then I'll rely on the research to figure out, what cut was that? What charcuterie was that?
Now, as somebody who obviously has a pretty good palate put together, is there any junk food that you still partake in regularly? Do you have a sweet tooth or a fast food diet?
I think that's just a common misconception. Like, I love to eat shit. Yeah. I love to eat good stuff. Like, I remember once we went out, my wife and I, we went out for a really nice steak dinner. It was really expensive and it was delicious. It was really good. But we went out at like 5:30. And so by like 10:30, we were both hungry. So we're like, let's go get some Taco Bell.
Yeah.
So we got some Taco Bell.
It's in the neighborhood.
Exactly. It's right there. And so I think to myself, what is my stomach saying right now that I have like $100 steak and like a $5 cheesy core burrito sitting in the same, occupying the same space? But I had this conversation pretty in depth with my wife just maybe about a couple weeks ago. What I find good and what you find good, usually there's a nice overlap. There's a nice chunk. And what you find bad, I'm probably going to find bad. I'm not going to enjoy as well. So as long as that good square has some of that overlap, I'm going to enjoy it and I'm going to eat it. There might be a varying level where you, like, as the person who lives in America, you love the tour of Italy at Olive Garden. I will respect that to the day you die.
Yeah.
That you will get that every time and you love it. And if I have to go to Olive Garden and get the tour of Italy, I'm going to eat it and it's fine. It's not, inedible. It's not bad. But if you get something where you're like, this is gross, I'm probably going to agree with you. It's not going to be good. So there's overlap there.
If you're stuck at Olive Garden, the Zuppa is a very good soup. I love a potato-based soup. And the soup salad and breadsticks is a great little combo. I don't need much, but they'll refill your soup bowl.
Yeah, Tiffany's mother-in-law, she is a huge lover of Olive Garden, and that's my go-to. I get the soup and salad, and I stick with it.
That's all you need. Pasta.
But, I do pine for those old days of those old breadsticks, because those breadsticks used to be outstanding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And now they're just salty sticks of okay.
I couldn't tell you the last time. It was probably when I was in high school that I've been to an Olive Garden. But
you're not missing it.
You're
missing the Andy's candy. That's what you're missing.
Yeah, you can buy that
anywhere. You can buy this anywhere, though.
One thing that I am actively trying to do, and I haven't talked about on the podcast yet, but I would like to make sure that my audience knows who I am outside of this. I've always struggled with fast food when I was doing traveling sales, especially. And on my 30th birthday, I made the decision to stop. And today we are just over 2 weeks since I turned 30, and I'm 430 miles from the drive-thru. So I'm going to continue to make that the goal, is to get as far away from eating garbage as I can. I still eat pizzas. I still, you know, eat more than I should more often than not. But I am actively working on cutting something out of my life right now. So.
Congratulations. That's a very earnest undertaking, because it is so easy to fall into that. And it's, I mean, to be fair, it's also easy to avoid it, because you just don't go there.
That's right.
Because no one's ever going to be like, oh, look, I planned us a really nice night tonight. We're going to go to McDonald's. We're going to have a romantic meal. And no one's ever going to say that.
No.
It's just very easy to avoid.
But it's like, oh, I'm running late for work, and McDonald's is in the strip where I'm down there, or Taco Bell's right at the bottom of the hill where I live. So it's like, okay, well, they're right there. But now, like, even on Sunday, somebody was coming over to pick up extra Kennywood tickets that I had that were going to expire. And they were like, I'll pick you up some Taco Bell as I'm pulling out. I go, don't. I'm fine. And I was like, it was a conscious thing. I was like, no, that's good. Yeah. I don't need that.
Good for you. I wish you all the luck on that. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Definitely. I hope the listeners will feel free to ask me about it when you see me in the streets. That's something I'm working on and I'm trying to get better at. So definitely need accountability above all other things. One thing that I am excited to see is your new house team over at the arcade. Dave is on a short form team called Game Shark, and I am on a short form team, a long form team over there called SideQuest. And you just had your first show. My team just had our first show, our second show by the time this airs. Talk to me about getting back into short form after a long hiatus.
Yeah, so growing up, I took classes at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and that was our bread and butter, was doing the short form games and nice and fun things. And then up at college, I did short form there. We had a small, you know, it was a pretty large grouping, but I played a very small role in it. I wasn't a regular cast member. No. I definitely wasn't as featured as I am now. So it was like getting back into a comfortable fitting pair of pants. And it's so different from long form, and it's so refreshing to know. And the team that I'm on now is outstanding. I'm so impressed with so many of the other people that I never had the chance to play with at all. And so I really like to thank the arcade for giving me the opportunity to be on the short form team, especially not having seen me do too much short form. I did a Comedy Royale, and that was quite fun. It was quite different. But I think that was one of my biggest short form excursions, other than just being on Game Shark. And I'm really excited when we're going to be on the same night. I think they're rotating it enough.
They do rotate pretty regularly.
So we can perform on the same night. That'll be awesome.
With short form, do you have a favorite game?
I love the guessing game. So the one was the train murder train. So everyone kills each other with a different weapon and a different style.
Oh, very
and they're
cool.
A different role. And then it's passed like telephone down the line until the last person guesses, and then what they get right, the next person tells them or doesn't, and then we find out down the line. And my favorite thing to do is just create the most outlandish guesses and make people laugh.
Yeah.
And so I love that concept there.
As somebody who has not done short form and is sometimes a cynical dick, I'll admit that, and I'm ignorant to some things. As an audience member, or as somebody who does long form, to me, the knock I would have on short form is you're just practicing in front of people. So how do you tell somebody like me that I'm wrong and sell me on short form, I guess?
Well, I think it's unfair to say that short form is practice, because so many elements of short form don't translate directly into long form. There are a lot of smaller scene shows or smaller scene games that you can absolutely say, like, well, you have to find place thing, but you have to do it at a much quicker, more condensed timeline than mm-hmm. long form. Long form, you're like, let's play this game, let's walk over here, let's do this. And, maybe it's not 2 minutes or 3 minutes into the scene until we've decided who each other is or what the scene's really about. In short form, you have 15 seconds, and it's like, this is what it's about, this is what we're going to do. And that's only when it's a scene game. When it's not, when it's a game where it's like, here's the concept and we're going to do one-offs, or here's the line and it's punchy, you have to be so much quicker than in long form. And that's every single person.
Yeah.
That's not just in short form, I'm sorry. Because in long form, you can always rely on somebody else to come out and do that and deliver that punchy line. But in short form, that's up to everybody up on stage. And that's usually, that's everybody, every member of the team.
I've been persuaded. I think that was really good.
Thanks.
You've done this before.
Oh, thank you.
Besides the Well-Known Strangers and Game Shark, obviously your two current teams, Panic, we've talked about a little bit. What are some of the other teams that people might recognize you from if they haven't been around in a while?
That's it in terms of formalization.
Okay.
Yeah, I've done some one-offs. I've done some duos. One of my favorite duos I ever did was with Mike Pedito. We did a duo called Mike and Dave.
Nice.
Where we asked the audience for a movie, and they gave us Annie Hall, and then we just made up a fake movie. Because both of us love movies.
Sure.
And so we just did weird stuff, and it made us laugh. And I just had such a good time because there was a frog, and there was a princess, and there was a musical number at one point. And it was like, yeah, this is Annie Hall. And we bookended it like a Roger and Ebert, where it's like, my favorite part of this movie was when this happened, and then we would do it. And it was just fun because we just played by our own rules, did our own thing.
Now, were you involved with Mid-Season Replacement with Mike?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Okay, it's okay.
That's one of those things. You know, they say you deny a lot of trauma in your life.
Yeah.
Mid-Season Replacement, to this day, is one of, probably even more than Panic, my favorite experiments that I was involved in. Because it was so unique, and it was so different.
For the audience who might not know, I've not seen them seen this group perform before, but I think it's one of the cooler ideas for... an improv
keyword
show.
Idea.
Yeah. Yes.
So we had our main members of the team, and then we had our coach run a soundboard with laughter, studio audience clapping, studio audience going, aw, studio audience going, woo. And we had theme songs that were built into there. So every episode was a sitcom. And most of the time, we couldn't pull it all together. But some of the concepts were just so amazing. And if it were ever to be brought back, so I'm speaking directly to Mike right now because I've been fighting him for a long time about bringing it back because I want it to come back. A cast member has to be the person working that board. They have to be the one who's a part of that scene, who's supporting when they need to, who's either painting where they need to
find a way to build it into the sideline and not in the booth sort of a setup.
Exactly. Yeah, so that member needs to be an active member. They need to have it at practice. Every practice needs to have the soundboard built into it, and it needs to be run as a member of the team.
Sure.
Because the way we did it was we had our coach run the board.
And that makes sense.
He had ideas of when to put it in and when to do it, but it wasn't a consistent thing that we had built into our practices and built into.
Yeah, it has to be treated like it's a character in the show. The soundboard has to be a regular piece of
work. There were some amazing people on that team, too, like Matt Lanning and Tamer Siegert and Patricia Campbell and just Alex Rogers. And we just had such a good – and, of course, Mike Pedito and Chris Wright.
Patricia and Alex, we miss you a lot. I haven't seen either of you in a couple months. I hope Alex is feeling well.
Yeah. Absolutely. I feel terrible now. Can you cut that part out about me forgetting it?
Oh no.
I'll just say, "Oh yeah, Mid-Season Replacement." Of course. Cuz no, that team was just incredible. That was super fun. I'd always had a good time with them.
When it comes to sitcoms, do you have any favorites from youth or today?
Oh man, growing up I was absolutely a TGIF kid through and through, and I was just always in love with the weird episodes. So like a Family Matters, whenever they did Steve-el. So when
Steve
and he had the robot Stefan it got weird and bizarre. And it didn't make any sense. And those were the episodes that I absolutely loved. Like I remember an episode of it was Punky Brewster.
Okay.
Where like they were trapped in a cave and she had these weird hallucinations where everyone was dying around her and there were like ghosts and skeletons. And it was so uncomfortable because there's no studio audience laughter at that point. It becomes silence. And it was just a bizarre episode. And those were some of my favorite episodes. Like I remember, I don't know if it's really like funny, but the episode of All in the Family where she gets sexually assaulted by the guy. And it's like, it's so fucked up. But I love those kind of episodes where it's just like, everyone's uncomfortable, but this is a sitcom, so you don't know how to react. And then at the end, they still have like the light clapping when they go into credits. And it's just like, oh man.
What do you think the appeal of Archie Bunker as an everyman was? I just feel like sometimes like we want it to be like he's appreciated as a TV character, but maybe I feel like the average person who's watching All in the Family like thinks that's how Carol O'Connor is. Like, and that's like, he's like me. He says what I think.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a fear of that bonding, I guess, through that. Like, oh, he's not afraid to say it how it is. But in reality, he was a pretty terrible character.
Right.
He's a really awful father, and he was an awful husband, and just an awful American, too.
Well, it's like my favorite television character of all time is George Costanza, who is infamously the worst of the four of them, and none of those four are good people. But George is like, let me just find the crummiest way to get out of stuff.
And I think what was amazing was that Larry David's constantly said, like, that was me. That was the decisions that I made and the person that I was. And so for him to, and then even Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Very much so, yeah.
Him as him. It's just like, wow, you live a messed up life. But I'm absolutely Seinfeld. I used to watch that every single night with my dad on reruns and live when they were on. So it's just like that was a defining show for me in terms of comedy, in terms of even like that's how when people ask me what I do with improv, that's what I say. So it's an episode of Seinfeld.
I tried
because it starts with Jerry and it starts with Elaine and it starts with Kramer and all their stories are very separate. And over time, they start to intertwine and they end up all together at the end. And that's a Herald.
Yeah, that's very, very accurate to what it would be in an ideal world when it works.
Exactly.
And when it works well, it's the best thing you can see. And when it doesn't, it is tough to get through. But
truly.
No different than stand-up or any other art form that's on the fly and a little bit improvised.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also went to a college in Ohio, as did I. You're a Case Western graduate.
Yeah.
And over dinner, I was very impressed to find out that you kind of created your own degree program.
Yeah, so I got to Case. I had the very grandiose idea of being a marine biologist when I grew up. That didn't work out too well, so I went with psych.
Hole in one.
Yeah, exactly. I pulled this from the belly of the beast and holds the Titleist up. I love that element.
Said, easy, big fella.
That's so good. The sea was angry that day, my friends.
Like an old man sending back soup at a deli.
That's such a good line. So the Art Vandelay approach, that was over for me. And so I did a psychology degree, and then I worked with the Dean of Arts and Sciences to create my own cinema studies major. So that's what it says under my diploma, psychology and cinema studies. So that and a bag of nickels will get you a candy bar at a convenience store.
As a lover of film and cinema, do you have like a good memory of some of the first films you got to see as a kid or go to theater to check out?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, film was always a huge part of my life. My dad is a huge lover of cinema. I remember being way too young. I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I just found the VHS copy of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and so I popped that baby in. And that pretty much messed me up for the rest of my life, and that's why I am the way I am. I love horror movies. I love messed up film and horror. I love really dark comedy. And just seeing that my dad's a huge lover of genre films, so horror, sci-fi, fantasy. So growing up, like Star Wars was my bread and butter. And like I knew these films like in my heart. And so growing up, going to see films with him, we had our Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles growing up, and we had our Independence Day as the real blockbuster. So I would love to seek out those kind of films, and I just sought out more obscure films and deeper films and. When I was in college, our library system was just absolutely incredible. And so I would order like 5 or 6 movies a week. And I'd just sit there in my room and I'd stay up all night watching these films. And it really helped shape who I am and the way I discovered the world. Because you can see, every time you watch a movie, you're capturing exactly what was going on at that time and place in that, you know, that part of the world with that writer, that director. And it's just like the time capsule. You can never uncapture, you can never capture that any other way.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. It's an amazing view into a world that I love.
One of the things that my family always gives me a hard time about is me proclaiming things to be classics that I consider to be classics, but maybe most people don't. The one that I'm teased for the most often was Angels in the Outfield. But if you get a movie with Danny Glover, Christopher Lloyd, and a young Joseph Gordon-Levitt together, and the Pigeon Woman from the sequel of Home Alone, that's a win. I mean, that's, you can't beat that. But it's not a classic. I actually was then told by my aunt and uncle, they looked it up, that it has to be at least 25 years in order to be considered a real classic. You can be an instant classic or a modern day classic prior to that. But I think that's based off of the idea of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame being 25 years after your first album was released, that you can be eligible for inclusion. So one thing I wanted to do for this is to look at the top 10 movies from 25 years ago, 1991, and talk about a few of them.
If you have, so that is so depressing that was 25 years ago.
Yeah, right?
You mean 91, like last week, right?
It felt like it.
Yeah.
The number one grossing movie that year, Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Okay. Classic. Special effects, top notch, turning into Mercury, going through the prison T-1000,
yeah,
chasing you down.
One of the one of those some classic scenes. Even if you haven't seen that movie, you've seen it parodied in The Simpsons, and enough other films have done homages to it over the last few years.
And not only that, a revolutionary VHS box as well with that giant face, that endoskeleton.
I love
that box.
The number two grossing movie, Robin Hood, Prince of Tides.
Never saw it.
I didn't either.
Yeah. Kevin Costner, I believe. I feel like somebody else was big as like the bad guy in that, but I don't remember who.
As comedy guys, though, I'm sure you've seen Robin Hood, Men in
Tights. I was just going to say, I was hoping you were going to say Men in Tights.
I wish. No.
So I could say Locks and Bagel. It's the perfect combination. I mean, Men in Tights, that was a defining movie for me with like Chew, Dave Chappelle, and like, it's just like, just amazing jokes, and Mel Brooks just killing it at every step. Paul Prudhomme, it's just like incredible. Cary Elwes was absolutely spectacular.
We don't get no tolls, then we don't get no ropes.
Call the locksmith. So good.
Wait, you changed the name to Latrine?
Sir, you've been caught so long, you've grown a lovely pair of breasts.
Yeah, so sorry, Prince of Tides.
Yeah,
we're not
helpful. We like Men in Tights.
Number three, Beauty and the Beast.
Tale as old as time.
Song as old as rhyme.
We just saw it again because they did the re-release.
Sure.
A couple years back.
The 25th anniversary.
Yeah. And we went to go see it. I never realized in the entire film they never name what that dude's name is. So the Beast.
Oh, really?
So as soon as he turns, he's like, hey, it's me. Carl. Like, what is your name? Okay. And meanwhile, you have a house full of people that are obviously going to be severely malformed.
Yeah.
Tables, chairs, things that have scuffs.
God, he's probably missing half of his face.
He's dead. He's a dead child.
It was an important part of his body.
Hopefully he didn't need that.
Right?
Yeah.
Number four, Hook, which was my childhood. I remember we would take long drives. My parents are from upstate New York. We had family in Pittsburgh, and we were in Ohio. We were in Louisiana. We were in a couple of different places. So traveling, we had a TV that we would plug into the cigarette adapter and put between the drivers and passenger seats so my brother, sister, and I could watch. And Hook was always our go-to first movie because it's just over like 2 hours and 15 minutes or so. It's a longer kids movie, but it got us far enough away before we were allowed to ask if we could stop anywhere. So that was always the go-to first movie for road trips as a kid.
I love that metaphor of like the Lost Boys were guiding you away from your town
to
wherever you were going on a trip, and you couldn't ask where you were going how long it was going to take. You just had to sit with them and make fake dinners and just enjoy yourself in your back fake world in the back of this car. That's incredible.
Yeah, that was Bangarang my childhood. Bangarang. Number five, a Pittsburgh movie, Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, classic. That's probably one of my favorite horror films of all time. Just the characters are just so incredible, especially when you don't know enough about the movie and you're like, oh, Hannibal Lecter, the bad guy in the movie. And it's like, no, he's not the bad guy.
And he's only in, I want to say, 20 to 25 minutes of the entire film.
Yeah.
And to do such a good job of capturing things. My cousin's wedding was actually at Soldiers and Sailors.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so there's that plaque there that explains that that's where the scene where the infamous glass box is where he's kept in the room. So that was kind of like, oh, it's a very romantic place to be married.
Yeah. And then you take your dick and you tuck it between your legs and you do the duck walk for everybody.
Do you think I'm pretty? I think I'm pretty.
What's your big, great big fat woman? I love that line. I don't know.
The number six movie is JFK, which I have not seen. It's an Oliver Stone one.
Again, the only reference I get is from Seinfeld when they show the Zapruder film and it's back and to the left. The guy hit with the spit at the baseball
game. Oh, with Keith Hernandez.
There's no way he could have hit him with the gum. He's like, that is one magical piece of gum. But no, I've never seen. Again, Kevin Costner. Look at us.
We are not supporting Kevin Costner. You think it's because we grew up when Waterworld was
I was just going to say that. Waterworld and The Postman. Just
pieces
of shit movies. We were just like, no.
No,
sorry,
I'm
Kevin.
Good without that.
Yeah, we're good without you, Costner.
I don't know. I love A Field of Dreams.
Yeah, I'm not a baseball guy.
Yeah, I see.
What did I like here?
Moonlight Graham. I'll just say that to people sometimes just because I think it's fun. Like, what? It's from that movie.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
I just know if you build it, they will come.
There
just
you
like
go.
Everybody
yeah.
else.
That's the other one. You want to have a catch, maybe and his dad. It's a nice like father-son movie.
Seems like it.
Yeah. Number seven, The Addams Family.
Oh, classic.
One of those great movies. What a good cast.
Oh.
Top to bottom, everybody kind of fits the characters you thought they would be.
Except for Pugsley. Whatever happened to him?
Yeah, that's true.
Nobody knows.
Ugh, sorry, buddy. Everybody else did.
Everybody
of
else
picks.
Was amazing. So good.
I'll watch anything with Christopher Lloyd. That's my.
He's just he's made to be Uncle Fester.
Yeah,
and that was again as a tiny nerd growing up in the '90s. Fester's Quest for Nintendo. That was like on constant rotation.
Sure.
I love that. And I love Adam's Family and the movie. And it was just weird. And even Adam's Family Values was good.
The summer camp.
Yeah.
Yep. Wednesday's great. Christina Ricci at her prime.
Excellent, yeah.
Number eight, a nice kind of scary, not horror movie, but Cape Fear. Nice psychological build, and De Niro is so good in that one.
Never seen it.
Oh.
But I do know the one scene where Uncle Leo is hanging from the rafters, and he's full doing the pull-ups, saying, "Hello, Jerry." And I know that's from Cape Fear.
Yeah.
And also The Simpsons.
The Simpsons. Is that Sideshow Bob? Sideshow Bob, that's right. Mm-hmm. At the
movie theater.
Yep.
Yeah,
the number nine in a comedy film, Hot Shots.
Oh, that's a classic. Was that a Zucker Brothers?
I think so.
Yeah, that was when they were at their prime.
Yeah,
Airplane and Hot Shots, and even Hot Shots Part Deux, and it's like classic comedy. Just it didn't even have to be a film. It was just like, here's a funny joke that we have. Let's throw it in. Let's make it work.
Well, that's like with Airplane. The goal was to have one joke per page on the script, so there was no lags. You wanted at least one laugh out loud joke at least every page of the script, and they nailed it. That's one of those movies that never stops being funny.
Yeah, it made a killer, definitely.
The number 10 spot, one of those favorites of mine as a title bomb family movie, City Slickers.
A great, great film. That was an ensemble cast. Billy Crystal and what's his name from
Daniel
Home
Stern.
Daniel Stern.
Bruno Kirby is in the second one. No, he's in the first one.
He's in the first,
It's Lovitz replaces him in the
That's
sequel.
Right. That's right.
The Quest for Curly's Gold.
The world famous Jack Palance.
Yes.
With the grim stare that could kill a cow from 1,000 yards. Yeah, City Slickers. That was, again, just one concept that they just made work into a movie.
As a young Jewish boy in Ohio, for me, and here in Pennsylvania for you, Billy was kind of the guy.
He was our man.
You saw him. It was before Stiller was what he is now. Billy was really the only guy I had that I was like, he's Jewish, and it's clear that he's Jewish, and he's such a good actor. I fell in love with movies like Forget Paris. I'm a big Deborah Winger mark. And I mean, everything he's done throughout his career, I would put up against. I mean, Mr. Saturday Night and everything on SNL too. But I'm a big Billy Crystal fan. 700 Sundays is great too. If you're looking,
I've heard that's amazing.
Book
really
and
deep.
Then the play I think is on HBO. His one man show of it.
Yeah, I think I found that connection with Mel Brooks. I think that was who I joined up with. I was like Spaceballs and Blazing Saddles. And it's just like it meant the world to me that I could see this very strong, very Jewish character doing so well, and you know, kind of playing the joke of it, like, look, I'm so Jewish.
I'm in on it,
right? This is my joke, and even the critic too. Growing up with John Lovitz,
that was one my dad, my brother, and I watched almost every week on TV. I remember as far as like being a TGIF kid,
exactly, a constant rotation. It was like, this is an idol for me. This makes it realistic. This makes it seem like, oh, I could do this. I could go into this because, you know, people of all kinds, especially my people, are accepted.
Yeah,
in this kind of thing. And so it was funny to me that stereotype growing up of like, oh, all the Jews are in Hollywood. I'm like, really? I don't know any. Do you know somebody? Tell me. Who could I meet? Who do I know? I don't know anyone.
As far as looking for acceptance and feeling good, as we just hit the 1 hour mark, so we'll start to wind down a little bit. You've been married for about a year and a half now.
Yeah, it'll be 2 years in March.
What was it about Tiffany compared to the other women in your life, as someone who's out there on the hunt for love? What is it that made you know that she was the person you were meant to be with?
It's a lot of things, definitely. It's not because love is a multifaceted thing. The major elements for me was she was her own person. So we both brought a lot to the table. Like, I have a lot of stuff that I like, and she has a huge list of things that she likes. So even if there's only a little bit of overlap, it works too, because I can go off and I can do my thing. She can go off and she can do her thing. But at the end of the day, we want to be together. We want to spend that time together. And that's what makes it nice. And then having the conversations, real conversations with someone who doesn't agree with everything you say, who doesn't hold the same opinions that you hold. But even when you disagree, you find that common ground. You say, you know what? I respect that. That's fine with me. We don't agree with it. But the important things, the major things, like the big, you know, of course, religion, politics, how you view life, you know, that kind of thing. That's where you click. That's where you stick up on. But if you have different opinions on, you know, small things, even things that are important to you but aren't as important, it's still okay. It's still fine to make that compromise. And then the quiet moments. You know, you can plan something and do something with everybody. At the end of the day, if you're not happy just sitting there next to the person, you know, then you know maybe it's not the relationship you want to stay in. But just with her, it's just like, every moment I'm with her is just a better moment, just for the simple fact that she's in that room and I'm in that room. And that's just, that's how I know. Like, growing up, like, I never had, I was a lonely child, definitely. I feel like a lot of comedians are lonely kids. That's why you find comedy as your outlet. And so I felt like this is it. This is how it's going to be forever. It's just me doing my own thing. And so that's why I grew so many passions for film and comic books and video games and, you know, going to the movies and watching things. Things I could do by myself. Things that I was happy to do solo. And I still enjoy those things now. And it doesn't make them any less important, but they were more important to me back then. So I can still have those things, and I can still have them as part of my life, but I don't need them as much as I used to. That distraction.
Yeah, sure. You don't feel... there's an emptiness that comes with needing all of those things to make you feel something, and now you have that in a dynamic with your partner.
And I still love things. Don't get me wrong.
Trust me. I
love stuff. Yeah. I mean, I still have way too many DVDs, and I still have way too many comic books.
I was going to ask about comic books. Is that still a collection you keep?
It's tough. I've cut my list back very strongly. I used to buy a lot of comics, and now I buy maybe two or three a month, but I still have a lot that I got to get rid of. So it's one of those things you just, you know, you cope with and you grow through and you appreciate, and appreciations change.
Now, with comedy, do you have goals in mind for what's coming next? I know we talked a little bit about dinner. You're not somebody who's looking to make a career out of this. This is something you do for fun, to play, to enjoy. But it's still okay to have goals or things that you want to accomplish. Is there anything you're looking to do over the next few months or year?
Oh, man. I wish I had, like, a great, you know, profound answer, but it's just until it stops being fun, that's when I'll do it. You know, it's the same with the blog. I'm not doing it for lots of readers or lots of feedback. It's just something I enjoy doing, something I like to do. I love to get on stage. I love to make people laugh, and that's just like, that's my bread and butter every single day of my life. So as long as I can keep making people laugh and I'm still having a good time doing it and I still have a forum to do it, I'll just keep doing it.
With improv being fleeting and something that happens once and is never to happen again, do you have any favorite lines or scenes that you've been in over the course of your career that stick out?
I've done a lot, and I'm sure a lot stick out for other people a lot more than they stick out for me.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was a young kid, this was like, I was really young. I was maybe like 8 or 9, and I was in an acting class, and we were doing an improv scene. And I left the scene. It was like me and my wife. And I left the scene. And then I came back in. And she said, "Wow, you're back really early. What happened?" And I said, "Work burned down." And that is one of the elements that, like, yeah, that's why I'm home. I went to work, and now I'm home because work burned down. And that's just one of those things that sticks with me. Like, you can justify anything, and you can make it work, and you can make it happen. And my parents still love that line. So I'm proud of that moment as a young ingenue.
Do your mom and dad still come see you do improv now?
They do. I'm so lucky to be an only child of Jewish parents. So I'm their world. And,
sure.
And they come out for the show, and I'm very, very lucky to have them. It's just so important to me, that connection that we have as family, as friends, and it's beautiful.
Well, this episode will come out either right after or during the high holiday period. So to the listeners, if there's anything I've done to offend you over the last years, real or imagined, please accept my sincere apologies. I am only trying to do my best, and I hope that you understand that I'm not a perfect person, but if I have done anything over the year, I please hope that I can have your forgiveness.
Forgive us, pardon us, and grant us atonement. That's a beautiful time.
Yeah, absolutely. Have an easy fast if it has happened or if it hasn't happened. Either way, enjoy that moment. For those of people that want to find me, you can always check me out at Dropping Bombs on Twitter or my Facebook page, Garrett Teitelbaum. It's nice to see he's working. I host trivia every Thursday night at the Beer Hive down in the Strip District. Starts at 7 o'clock. You can win prizes. And you can see me doing stand-up all over town at a variety of venues. Just make sure you ask me where or follow me, and I'll tell you. Dave, What do you got going on?
Well, you can find me with well-known strangers every Thursday night at the CLO Cabaret backstage at 10 p.m. You can find our Facebook page, Well-Known Strangers. You can also check out my food blog, DavidTheGastronome.com. I have an Instagram as well. You can follow that. Facebook page, you can follow that. You can just find me on the street, give me a wave, and say hi. And then the Well-Known Strangers has a for fairly random monthly shows here and there. And then my new team, Game Shark, you can find us at Bonus Stage inconsistently. I guess it's like every two or three weeks.
It's two a month, and it rotates what the dates are.
Okay. So, yeah, check out Arcade Comedy Pittsburgh. Check them out and look for the schedule for both Game Shark and SideQuest. Come check out Garrett and I doing
absolutely
some arcade house teams because we couldn't do it without you.
We need you there. You're the audience. Yeah. You make or break the whole show. We love you. Thank you for hanging out. Dave, it was a great meal. Thank you for including me.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for choosing, for helping choose the place. It was absolutely a spectacular meal.
Man, I really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit better, and I hope the audience did as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, bud.
Thank you.
Mother Street Recordings, a podcast collective.